think it's important that we go beyond these simplistic or straightforward framings of waste as inherently bad or dangerous or dirty, and perhaps to reimagine waste as something that could potentially be meaningful, like as a resource for making meaning, for constructing identities.
Welcome to Zetnopod. At the mic, Michelle Fondach, and today in front of me are Charmaine Kong, Alessandro Pellanda, and Laura Wohlgemuth from the Department of English at the University of Bern. Since 2023, you work as a team of PhD students for the SNSF project Articulating Rubbish. You are social linguists, and your research explores the relationship between language and, let's say, the many implications around it. During your research, you collected data in Switzerland and beyond, such as in Hong Kong. I remember 2 years ago when I met you the first time, it was at a workshop at the University of Zurich. I learned about your studies and I was immediately fascinated about it. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing with us insights about your research. So first of all, more broadly, Charmaine, what is your team working on exactly, and what are you working on more specifically?
First of all, thank you so much for inviting the three of us. Our project is called Articulating Rubbish, and in short, we're interested in examining the relationship between language and waste. So how language plays a role in shaping the way that people talk about waste, but also how they think about waste and make sense of waste in their everyday lives, whether it be in the context of news media or at the level of municipal policy making, in domestic households or in institutional settings. And the premise is that people use words to define what counts as waste or what doesn't count as waste, what is valuable or not. And so we use language to negotiate what is of value, what is of lesser value, and so on. And specifically for me, I try to study this connection between language and waste from a transnational perspective beyond the local Swiss context, and specifically in Hong Kong, which is also where I grew up in and where I come from. And the focus of my project lies more in the work of waste, so the labor of waste and the cultural politics of blue-collar work. So rather than focusing on the production of waste or the consumption of waste per se, I'm more interested in the backstage management and regulation of waste work behind the scenes. And so a large part of my research has been to document the social lives and the narratives and the everyday talk of waste workers by asking, how do these cleaners talk about the work that they do? How do they make meaning from their work or create value from trash through their everyday engagements and experiences living and working with waste?
Thank you so much for introducing your research, which is so fascinating, and that's the reason why we invited you to this podcast. Laura, what is your research focusing on?
As Charmaine already explained, I examine this intersection between language and waste in the cultural context or frame of domestic life. I'm kind of interested in the ways people discuss what counts as waste or what counts as valuable in everyday life. So the kind of waste that you and I daily create. My project is inherently interested in the role of language and institutions in producing broader regimes of value. So I'm interested in everyday storage practices. For instance, in Swiss households, many of them have cellars, and I kind of investigate the cellar as a space where people negotiate that in between, between something that's treasurable and that is put on display, but not yet discarded. I also look at the informal practice of curbside cleaning. It's called Gratis zum Mitnehmen here in the German-speaking part of Switzerland. And it's this informal practice of leaving no longer wanted items on the curb for others to retrieve. And what interests me there is the politics of value. So, you know, what does it mean in terms of moral economies that one person's trash can become someone else's treasure? In a nutshell, it's really investigating the ways in which discourse and our daily, you know, ways of communicating and doing things reinscribe broader social structures and infrastructures of waste.
Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to say these are acts that we perform every day unconsciously right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially because waste is something, you know, often made invisible, and waste is inherently organized by removal, by making it disappear from our lives. Alessandro investigates there are infrastructures behind this. It's about constructing a sense of a modern society, of a, especially in Switzerland, you know, institutions construct these mythologies of cleanliness, but of course they're not just there, they're socially constructed. And as Alessandro is going to say, they're also very much built into the system.
And you, Alessandro, you're focusing on the infrastructure.
Yes, my interest is really on waste governance, the way institutions govern waste. And I'm really interested in the material, spatial and visual language of this waste governance. Like, how does this waste governance take place across space, across material technologies? We can think about garbage bags, but also something really everyday and mundane, like the disposal calendar. And visual, especially in the messaging that goes out from institutions to the citizens. What kind of imagery, really, really mundane, you can see on a garbage truck? Who decided what goes in? What are they trying to communicate? Even if maybe most of us, we don't even realize what's on a garbage truck or a garbage bag. So really, I try to look at, I would say, everything in Switzerland from like really this specific garbage bag that, you know, as many of us know, we have to buy. I'm also interested in the design of decommissioned landfills, and particularly in the very architecture of incinerator plants, or as they're now called, waste-to-energy plants. So basically my argument in my sub-project is that these systems are not just functional, they're deeply communicative, because they teach us what we are allowed to see on waste, what we're not allowed to see on waste, and in doing so, they really communicate certain values and ideas.
I have a question. How did you end up researching this particular topic? What motivated you? But then when you thought waste, how did you came up with the idea?
I used to study in language and communication, and I've always liked the subject because I feel like, to me, sociolinguistics is about researching connections and interconnections. It's my personal connection to words, but then there's also the connection between language and material reality. When I came to Switzerland and I first started to study waste, I realized how waste, like language, is also deeply entangled in so many things, as you said. It's about social order, it's about moral economies, and waste is also a concept that's like deeply conceptualized in arts of in domains of arts and aesthetics. And it also has to do with regimes of governance and infrastructures. So I found that like inherently fascinating. I mean, all of us in one way or another, we're trying to open up opportunities for different people and different stakeholders to talk about their waste practices. And especially in my case, I'm trying to attend to voices and narratives that are typically left unattended or marginalized in society, because cleaners who work in major institutions like laundry workers in hotels or factory workers who work for financial offices and are responsible for the paper shredding and, you know, destroying confidential data. I also did quite a lot of ethnographic field work in these so-called underground blue-collar workplaces, you know, just to observe how they work and how they find meaning in the work that they do. And a lot of these cleaners whom I interviewed and talked to, they have never experienced anyone asking about their work or asking about how they make meaning out of the work that they do, because it is so deeply entangled in so many things.
Mm-hmm. And what about you two? How did you end up researching this topic?
I think both of us had an inherent interest in, you know, approaching waste, not as probably many of us do, as something that's made invisible, as something that's supposed to be disgusting or kind of expelled from, you know, the front stage of our everyday lives, but rather as something that we can learn to live differently with it, rather than just eliminate it. And I think, or at least speaking for myself, a major difference in the way I approach waste did make this book by a discard scholar called Gay Hawkins. It's called The Ethics of Waste, How We Relate to Rubbish. And in that, she kind of develops an approach to waste that doesn't try to moralize it. She also discusses the entire kind of waste education that goes into, you know, how people are schooled into recycling properly. But what she does with it is basically say that there are so many, she calls them disenchantment stories. So we're supposed to think that waste is bad, that waste is toxic. But she turns it around and instead says that, well, what about if we try to see waste as something productive, as something that tries to tell us something? We need to see, where does waste take place? You know, it's often behind the scenes. It's often concealed in a garbage bag. It's an awareness exercise on the one hand, but it's not supposed to be moralizing.
And this could bring us to the question about the cliché and the stereotypes that you encounter regularly about your topic. So is there a moment where you interact with non-scholars of waste and you have to teach them, no, actually, this is not the correct way, or this is a cliché, it's not really like that?
I would say, especially in conversation with friends and family, coming from the humanities and social sciences, I think the first cliche, it's always, why do we study this? Like, what's the use of what we're doing? Always there is this inherent implication that if the research doesn't generate profit or a direct technical fix, there is always this question, why are you critiquing a system that works so well? You know, why we're like the cleanest country in the world? And I think it's fun because for me, it's a reaction. It's already kind of informal data collection that tells me that cleanliness, this idea of order, it's so entrenched in the part of Swiss national identity that the moment you start criticizing it, people really feel attacked personally. Mm-hmm. And I always try to say that as we make waste disappear from view, a lot of other stuff we make it disappear from view to just say Switzerland is really nice. But when you pull the curtain and start looking behind, the way we make waste disappear is, it really mimics and mirrors a lot of ways that we make other stuff disappear from people, money. It goes a long way. So I always say, by the way we look at how we manage waste, it can really tell a lot about how we manage other stuff, to really give this image of a clean, advanced, civilized nation, country.
Right. So you can really say that waste is very politicized and is hiding some aspects of the governance. It's an erasure from everyday life. Why is it like that? Tell me more about this aspect of Swiss identity with cleanliness and the fact that waste is hidden.
I mean, I would start from maybe the premise that all these notions and idea of order and cleanliness are strictly Western, especially Central European. There is this correlation between Switzerland being one of the biggest worldwide producer of municipal solid waste because of the high standards of living. So we inevitably have to hide or erase all the waste we produce because we're, what, 9 million people, and we produce more waste than certain continents combined per capita. So we inevitably have to erase it, because if we were not to do, we would have to face the actual material and physical consequences of having landfills everywhere. So that's where it comes, all this cycle of erasure, that it really is to sustain this high standard of living, and more than living, it's the high standard of consumption.
And there is an intention in making waste disappear.
I would say an infrastructural level, yes, because if we take a country like Switzerland, again, 9 million people, really small country in the middle of Europe, we have 29 waste-to-energy plants. If you look at other neighboring countries, they may have a half with triple of the population. So it's the imperative here it's we need to make it disappear, especially since the changes in law over the past 30 years. Now it's all about, they're also not called incinerators anymore. They're called waste to energy plants, because all of a sudden waste, through language and communication and the way institutions talk about waste, it has become a really valuable resource. So we've been now told that a waste to energy plant is good because we can feed it waste and it can give out energy to it. But there is that central contradiction in saying, on the one hand, we have communication about going zero waste, reducing waste, and then on the other, we have 29 waste to energy plants that without waste, they wouldn't run. So it's all about this more or less hidden contradictions. I would say the waste to energy plant contradiction, it's in plain sight. It's just very well masked behind really aesthetic and pleasing buildings, behind greenwashing discourses. But it's imperative to being able to keep consuming this much, we need to make it disappear. Whether then it's done on site within the Swiss borders or some parts get exported elsewhere in other communities and countries, this is a whole other story. But the imperative is we need to make it disappear.
And the paradox is that to maintain this infrastructure active, we need to consume and produce waste at the same time.
I think that's where our project is interesting, to see what kind of communicative resources are being used to manage this contradiction. How can we go from zero waste discourse to, actually, when you visit the plant, they'll tell you that we need to keep feeding this oven because it can never stop. And then you start maybe looking at other countries like Denmark and Sweden, where they actually had to turn off some of these plants because recycling goes so well. And I now read that in China is the same. They start digging waste up from landfills to feed them into these plants because otherwise they just don't run. So it's really how we manage this contradiction that for me goes from institutions down to how workers make sense of this.
This would mean that Switzerland is an exceptional country compared to other countries in Europe, or exceptional in the way they manage waste?
I would say it's a special case because we really do invest a lot of resources to make it aesthetically pleasing. So what I was really intrigued since my master and since this language and waste seminar, it's a really basic question. Why do we spend so many resources on designing garbage bags? Why do we want them to be so aesthetically pleasing? Why have they become these branded artifacts that cities, municipalities, and villages employ to really brand their identity? And this, I think, was the driving force behind when I started. I was like, why are we doing this? It's something that most of the time, as Laura was mentioning, it's hidden in your home. You put it outside a couple of hours and then disappears.
And it's even, you put it outside in the mornings usually, so it's kind of also temporarily regulated. Outside of hours where people would regularly walk the street, it's a system which is designed to be hidden. Switzerland wants to maintain its national identity as a clean, orderly, punctual, you name it, country. And I think that really explains why there's so many resources and there's labor involved as well. Someone needs to clean up the streets so that they look nicely the next day. Someone needs to, you know, make the garbage bag disappear. In fact, I also did field work in Swiss secondhand shop Brockies, and I was interested also in who is doing the labor of sorting and deciding what can be reused and processed in order to be sold to someone else. And I think it's stuff that we forget. If we think that we donate something to a Brockie, we've done the right thing. But what we forget very often is labor involved in sorting out. It's a communicative system that's built into the way citizens are supposed to think about waste and supposed to talk about waste in a way that seems so normal, but actually it's very deliberately designed. It's governance because it's ingrained in their daily routines because they've been taught to place their garbage bag out at a specific time to bring their unwanted items down to the Brockie because it's virtuous, it's morally good. or many of us maybe misrecognize the way in which we daily reproduce the social structure by doing these actions in a way that seems so normal.
And all these actions are very unconscious.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because I think many Swiss, they proudly talk about the way they recycle and the kind of virtuous waste practices. In many ways, they don't necessarily talk about the more dirty stuff that happens behind closed doors, you know.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure.
When you mentioned the term social order, I was immediately reminded of Mary Douglas, who is a very famous cultural anthropologist, and how she famously noted that the way a society deals with dirt or deals with its discards inevitably exposes or reveals how that society is being organized or structured. And I was just thinking, this statement applies to Switzerland, it applies to, you know, the regimes of governance that Alessandro mentioned, but it also applies to many other places like Hong Kong, which is also a very wasteful city and a quintessential epicenter of capitalism and profit making. And I was just reminded of the lengths that institutions would go in order to maintain this illusion of hygiene and cleanliness and order in order to make profit. So in shopping malls, for example, there are multiple practices of concealment, like CCTV cameras, locked doors and locked backstairs. And these backstairs are locked precisely because that's where the cleaners rest and where they, you know, have work breaks and store their cleaning equipment. It's something that's meant to be hidden. So all of these are kind of surveillance mechanisms or practices of erasure that strive so hard to conceal these traces of waste work and waste workers who are marginalized. And yeah, and again, implicit in this kind of spatial segregation is again the assumption that waste is dangerous and dirty and therefore threatens the aesthetics or the hygienic order of urban cities.
So if we shift to recycling,
yeah,
as you mentioned just before, we think about recycling rules and the responsibility that individuals have on their shoulders to recycle, but also to demonstrate that they recycle to other people. This creates a big sense of morality and duty in people at the same time. How did you explore this recycling topic?
I would say, especially for our generation and the newer generations, it's almost, you're almost born in it. You didn't have to learn it. But it's exactly through language, communication, campaigns, anti-littering campaigns, recycling campaigns, slogans, the idea of this footprint, carbon footprint calculators. It's really through all these different modes of communication that the generations before have really moralized recycling. It was born out of being a moral framework to really on somehow make you feel guilty and shift the blame. NGOs like Greenpeace, they're rarely blaming the right actors. They're always blaming the individual, you as a citizen. In doing so, the blame shifts on you, while corporations who keep polluting and producing way more hazardous waste, they're left unchecked. They can keep going and going because all the focus is, you know, on us as citizens. We were looking at data from Switzerland and Europe. When you look at municipal solid waste, it's around the 6 to 9% of all the waste generated on a global scale of waste. And then you start looking, most of it, it's industrial waste, construction waste. And then you start thinking, well, all the communicative efforts go when you see the palette of all different types of waste, inevitably goes down to the citizen.
It's really about locating the pollution elsewhere. It's a fact that, of course, it's an easier fix to, you know, start at the individual, at the consumption level, and tell consumers to change their behavior. But of course, it's a kind of practice that's much easier to intervene in than changing the system, than changing industries.
I mean, speaking from the perspective of my sub-project, I think one of the major takeaways is that there are endless, infinite ways of living with waste and in the waste worker's case, working with waste, because waste is such a complex condition or quality in life that can be read or interpreted or experienced in so many different ways, depending on the cultural context, but also depending on who is looking. So it really is a matter of perspective. As Laura mentioned, the same piece of object can be considered disgusting or useless by one person, but maybe somehow meaningful and potentially profitable by another. So for example, to us, waste might be quite detached or even revolting, but to the waste workers who encounter it every day, to them, their living literally depends on it. They make a living out of waste. I think it's important that we go beyond these simplistic or straightforward framings of waste as inherently bad or dangerous or dirty, and perhaps to reimagine waste as something that could potentially be meaningful, like as a resource for making meaning, for constructing identities, because waste workers whom I interviewed, they share a very intimate relationship with waste. Many of the workers I interviewed, most of them are immigrant workers, typically gendered and racialized in the sense that they are female immigrants from Nepal, from the very different people coming from different backgrounds who experience waste in drastically different ways from we do. And that's also the point where I myself, as an academic researcher and as an everyday consumer, I start to become very aware of the privileges I occupy and the power imbalance between someone like me, who is free to, you know, shop and consume in a shopping mall, as opposed to those who are obliged to clean up after my mess every day.
We go back to the idea of the object that is first desired and then it becomes discarded. Mm-hmm. The moment the object is labeled as waste, it loses value and triggers feelings of repulsion, and the desire is desire for sensory distance. What moral and political processes lie behind this instant devaluation of waste?
When we say something is waste or trash or rubbish, it's not just a meaningless action, as, you know, banal as it may seem, but actually the way we talk about something, it shapes how we think about it and potentially how we act. This, you know, applies to an object. And I'm very much interested in the way we deal with object and how we talk about objects, how this is implicated in what we keep or throw. But I'm also interested in, you know, what are the power relations in that? So who is allowed to say what counts as valuable, as desired, or as discardable? So, of course, not everyone has the same authority to say so. And this might concern the very small scale, like a family, but of course it goes up. So institutions or institutional actors have a very different authority to determine or declare what counts as waste or not. And this trickles down when thinking about what is waste, how much value has a certain waste matter or object. The approach I like to take is to think about who has the power to define what is waste or not. And I think this is very context dependent, of course. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a literature tip for people interested in the topic of your research, like a book or an article? What could you recommend?
Gay Hawkins, The Ethics of Waste. I think all of us quite like that text. It really engages people's everyday relationship to waste in a way that many of us would never think about. It's really about noticing waste and the way we deal with it in our everyday lives.
I have two. So the first one would be the book by Joshua Reno, which is called Waste Away, Working and Living with a North American Landfill, which was really eye-opening. And the way he writes about his fieldwork and experience in actually working in this landfill as fieldwork, it was just insane. And it's really amazing. And I still cite it everywhere and keep reading it. You know, when you ask what pushed us to do this project too, it was just that no one in sociolinguistics has ever even got their hands dirty to even think about, you know, moving beyond classrooms and museums to actually see who's working in factories, who's, you know, doing this dirty work.
Thank you so much for this fantastic talk.